Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Lynn Sedway, real estate consultant and economist, and executive managing director of CBRE Consulting, and your chair and moderator for today's program. I'd also like to welcome our radio and TV audiences and remind everyone that you can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is a privilege to introduce today's speaker, the Honorable Alfonso Jackson, who is Secretary of HUD, the Housing and Urban Development Department. This couldn't be a more timely subject with the crises going on in today's mortgage markets. Secretary Jackson is going to speak on building the dream, putting home ownership on a strong foundation for the future. And in that talk, he will address our current housing crisis and the issue of foreclosures. The Honorable Alfonso Jackson has been Secretary of HUD, where it has been his mission to provide affordable housing and promote economic development. He first joined the Bush administration in June of 2001 as HUD's Deputy Secretary and Chief Operating Officer. He has, as Deputy Secretary, managed the day-to-day operations of the $32 billion agency, and he has instilled a new commitment to ethics and accountability within HUD's programs and among its workforce and its grant partners. He was unanimously confirmed as the 13th Secretary of HUD on March 31st, 2004. He has a very long career for somebody so young, and I won't read all of it just in the interest in moving on to the program. But he is an expert on public housing and urban issues, and he serves on a number of national and state commissions, most notably the General Services Commission of the State of Texas, where he previously served as chairman. He has a bachelor's degree in political science and a master's degree in education administration from Truman State University, and he received his law degree from Washington University School of Law. It is my privilege to present the Honorable Alfonso Jackson.
Thank you very much, Lynn, for the kind introduction, and I'm extremely pleased to be here, and I'm sure glad you think I'm pretty young. I'm not too young. It is a privilege to speak before the Commonwealth Club, and it's always good to return to California, a place that is both down to earth and at the same time larger than life. Just like your governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger. I had the pleasure of speaking with Governor Schwarzenegger recently to discuss the foreclosure issue. He is the latest in a line of great Americans who made California their home and whose life was uniquely Californian. Another one is a man who was alive when the Commonwealth Club was founded, Lynn. That was Mark Twain. Twain was not only a writer, he was an adventurous. And his adventure brought him here. It is said that during the gold rush, Twain tried his hand at mining. Legend has it that one day while at the Angel Camp, he quit panning just before coming across a sizable pocket of gold. That was too bad. Of course, he would soon find his fortune another way, and the whole world would be richer for it. What made Twain come to California? It wasn't the promise of government benefits or bailouts. No, what brought him here was a word called opportunity, the restless spirit of discovering that this is his birthright as an American. Twain said the nation is only an individual multiplier. He was right. And millions of citizens who came here to build their dreams ended up building a great state and a great nation. The question is, what did they find once they got here? Not gold, but high house prices. I want you to listen to a description of San Francisco in 1851. Lots of property is valuable and in demand. There is no such thing as an empty house. The present extravagant value of the property in San Francisco cannot continue to be long sustained at the rate that it's increasing. That's 1851. Of course, this would not be the last time housing prices in California would spike. In the 1990s, when the rush was for silicon, not gold, it seemed that the prices would never go down. But the higher they climb, the harder they fall. And this housing correction has been hard on all of us. Here's some of the facts. In January, sales of existing homes nationwide fell to the slowest rate since 1999. Sales are down 20% since their all-time high in 2005. Here in the Bay Area, home sales has fallen to a 20-year low. In 2005, there was just about a four-month supply of unsold homes in the United States. Today, it is 10 months supply. So owners want to sell, are slashing prices. This is good news for bargain hunters. However, many of them are waiting to see if the market has hit rock bottom. The twice shy, having seen most recent buyers get burned. Today, 1 in 10 homeowners are underwater, meaning they owe more on their home than their home is worth. Another factor, foreclosure filings in California is up 120% compared to January 2007. That's second only to Nevada and double the national average. A list of the nation's top 10 metro areas for foreclosure reads like you're driving down 99, including Stockton, Modesto, Mercedes, Bakersfield, Riverside, St. Bernardine. 60 Minutes recently interviewed a Stockton real estate agent who started Repo Bus. There are tours of vacant homes in Stockton. He got the idea from the Star tour that covers Beverly Hills. Now, some might laugh, but to me, foreclosure is no joke. I can tell you that it breaks my heart to see families having to pack away their dreams and memory in boxes. And it hurts to know how many others are affected indirectly. Communities suffer from vandalism, renters are evicted, and even pets are abandoned. Now, I don't want to exaggerate the problem because we've had enough of that. I will tell you that 93% of all the mortgages are being paid on time. Less than 2% are in foreclosure. And I can say to you that the vast majority of the subprime market were sound then and is sound now. The question that is presented to us today, what should we be doing about the rest of this issue? Last week, a bill that would have had the government buy up billions of dollars in subprime loans was defeated in the Senate. Like foreclosure itself, it would have created a new and indirect victims. Well, it would have distorted the market, raised interest rates, strangled credit for new homeowners, and the benefits would have helped lenders and speculators more than homeowners. I am convinced that Americans are fair people. They want to help, but they understand that the answer to the economic challenges must ultimately come from the people who drive the economy, not from the government. They want the tools of recovery in their own hands and to be empowered to use them as they wish. Above all, they do not want to kill the spirit of opportunity that makes our country great. And so today I want to talk to you about how we will put the American dream of home ownership on a strong foundation for the future. It starts with the most important element, the buyers themselves. You might say that home ownership starts, in my mind, with homework. See, Mark Twain said something that I think is real important. He said, by temperament, I was the kind of person that does things first and reflect afterwards. That's good for a writer, but it doesn't quite work for a home buyer. I have spoken to so many people who did not know what they were agreeing to sign on the dotted line. In some cases, the buyers were lured with teaser interest rates without understanding that those rates would double or even triple over time. Often lenders push the piggyback loans and other gimmicks that hit the true financial costs. And another real estate agent told 60 Minutes they were getting loans in excess of 100% of the value of the property. In other words, getting paid to buy a house. Now, I'm not going to let the buyer off because the buyer shares the responsibility also. Some did not read the prospectus. Many did not understand it. Often the benefits banded while the penalties were buried in the fine print. See, as the last of 12 kids, you get all the wisdom the other 11 miss. And I got a lot of wisdom. And I reminded me of a humorous line that I once read. It says, why is it that you can never read a doctor's prescription, but you can always read his bill? That's a good line, but it's a poor excuse. There are more ways than ever today to buy a home. And so we must educate the homeowner like never before. They must know their rights and responsibility on the way in, not just on the way out. In January, President Bush signed an executive order creating the Advisory Council on Financial Literacy. It is led by two distinguished Californians, Charles Schwab and John Hope Bryan. The role of the council goes beyond promoting ownership. We want families to know what goes into a home: planning, savings, good credit, all of the above, and communicating with your lender. People must, as the president said, be able to manage their assets. So we are sending out 4 million copies of a new brochure called Home Economics in both English and Spanish. It details 5 steps to become prepared to own a home. The most important step may be contacting a housing counselor. I will say something to you today that most people really don't realize. Most people who are in trouble do not even know that free housing counseling is available to them. There are more than 2,300 HUD-approved counseling agencies across the country, ready and able to help to end the process of foreclosure. This is not a trivial issue. This is at the heart of the matter. I ask you today to imagine that you are very sick. If a doctor told you to get a checkup and you'd have a 96% chance of survival, everyone in this room would do it. I can tell you that the first quarter of 2007, 96% of the households that saw a HUD approval housing counselor completed the program and avoided foreclosure. President Bush has increased housing counseling by 150%. And in the new budget, he's asking for $65 million. And talking to your governor, he just announced an $8 million federal grant program for housing counseling in urban and rural areas. But the president did not stop there. The president went further by adding another $180 million to NeighborWorks. And they began to distribute funds around the country last week. I can tell you that the counseling money is money well spent. The study shows that the homeowner's response is much quicker to a nonprofit group and to a community-based group than to the lenders or the banks. We must face up to something, though. Some people are in denial about their financial problems. Instead of picking up the phone, they withdrew. In fact, more than half of the homeowners in foreclosure did not discuss beforehand with their servicer or lender. And I will tell you what we found out in many cases since we started Hope Allowance. Lenders have even resorted to mailing out letters that look like wedding invitations to get the attention of people facing foreclosure. I will tell you today, we must change our attitude, but we can do that with the help of housing counseling, and I can tell you we are. But also, sometimes the fault lies with the mortgage process itself, Lynn. Unlike years ago, the mortgages are chopped up, sold, resold, until it's hard to figure out who's in charge and who to call. Last year, Secretary Paulson and I called on the mortgage industry to offer broad response, and they did, creating Hope Now Alliance. This represented 90% of the subprime market, and the Hope Now members have contacted more than 500,000 homeowners, and their hotline receives more than 4,500 calls a day. They recently announced a plan to help up to 1 million homeowners avoid foreclosure over the next 2 years through an initiative such as the teaser rate freeze. I am pleased with their action, but we must do more. Recently, the Hope Now members took another step. It's called Project Lifeline. It pauses the foreclosure process for 30 days so eligible at-risk homeowners can work with lenders and counselors to modify their loans if they're 90 days late. For our part at HUD, we're bringing together lenders and families. We've held dozens of foreclosure prevention workshops around the country, and I've been to many of them myself. And every time that I see denial and fear replaced with hope, it encourages me. Listen to the experience of Christine Barron of Rialto, California. Ms. Barron attended a recent foreclosure prevention workshop in Riverside. She and her husband had purchased a home using a mortgage they thought that were fixed. It was not. On the first reset, 2 years later, the payment increased by $2,000. But this is the kicker. It turned out that her lender servicer was in the Middle East. Every day for a month, she would get up at 5 a.m. to call and try to work something out. Nothing occurred. Finally, she called Hope Now, our hotline. If you want to get that, that's 1-888-995-HOPE. 1-888-995-HOPE. She was referred to a neighborhood housing services of Inland Empire. They were able to reach the lender, who agreed to a loan modification, and the interest rate was reduced, and their home was saved. And that's a great story and proof that foreclosure is not inevitable. In fact, it is preventable. Of course, there are some voices now whispering that the American dream is a mirage, that we can't help people. Well, I disagree. Again, to fall back on my mom and dad, I believe homeownership is still within the American dream. So I tell people to dream. My mom and dad taught me something that is very important. They said it might be insane to live with a dream, but it is absolutely madness to live without one. And so those people who talked about the dream was out of reach didn't count on President Bush's economic stimulus package, proof that Washington can get something done. Sometimes not too much. I said quite frequently, they asked me, why do I travel so much out into the heartland? I said, because Washington is 65 square miles surrounded by reality, because ain't much reality in Washington. But the plan has two major elements. First, it immediately release will go to homeowners who can pay down on their mortgages or other house-related bills. This will bring liquidity into the market and help break the cycle of foreclosure. Secondly, the plan raises the Federal Housing Administration's loan limit, enabling more families to qualify for safe, affordable FHA loans. Now, this is critical for California, where most families are currently priced out of the FHA bag loans. This has created a vacuum, which has been filled by the exotic subprime loans. But today, because of the stimulus package, we can help homes up to $730,000 will qualify in this state. We estimate that this will help tens of thousands of Californians. And I look forward very soon to making the announcement for your state. The chief economist for the National Association of Realtors predicted that the plan will have a big, immediate impact, especially in this state, causing for demand in the rising of housing. Unfortunately, the new loan limit expires at the end of the year. We need a more permanent solution. That means the modernization of FHA. Don't get me wrong. FHA has served us well, helping more than 35 million people buy homes, but it's showing its age at 74. 2 years ago, President Bush and I asked Congress to pass FHA modernization legislation. Our plan offered flexible down payment requirements, higher loan limits, past December 31st, when the stimulus package expires. It would also enable FHA to fairly price the product, take risks into account to reflect the market reality. We don't want anyone caught by surprise. FHA modernization could help 250,000 people this year alone if the Senate and the House can reconcile it. It's passed the House and the Senate, but it has not gotten to the President's desk. But because it has not, President Bush and I made an announcement of FHA Secure. It is helping responsible families who, because of the reset interest rate, find themselves falling behind on the mortgage payment. For the first time, they would be able to qualify for an FHA loan. And the process of foreclosure would be stopped. Now, the rules require that they were on-time payers from the very beginning. And let me tell you how effective it's been. Since the announcement was made in August, we have helped over 100 homeowners, current or past due on their loans, refinance through FHA. And by the end of the year, we believe we will help more than 300,000 more. This is quite a change. During the subprime explosion, FHA fell out of favor. We were called old-fashioned for documenting income levels. We couldn't compete with the gimmicks such as the ninja loan. And that simply means no income, no job, and no assets required. But let me tell you, today FHA is back. We've sent out more than 800,000 letters to tell people we're back, including 54,000 of them in California. And the scheme of shortcutting must be stopped. This brings me to the final goal. We must stop the dream breakers. Who are the dream breakers? These are the ones who steers the family into risky loans when they could not afford, when they could afford better loans at the bank, and whose shady practices promise them great rewards, but they're never kept. The dream breakers are also those who discriminate on the basis of race, religion, gender, sex orientation, family status, and disability. This is the 40th anniversary of the Fair Housing Act, and we've created the Fair Lending Division just to address the dream breakers. It is my belief that we've taken very serious steps, but it's still not enough. We must have the participation of our lenders, our mortgage brokers, mortgage bankers, and we must have cooperation from our cities and states. Therefore, we need to get rid of our regulatory barriers that create problems. That's why we created America's Affordable Housing Community Initiative. And what we're seeing is rather than adding excessive regulations that runs the prices up between 10 and 35%, which puts homes out of reach to a lot of people, let's work with them. In closing, let me say this to you. When President Bush asked me to lead this effort, I took it on vigorously because I've had the opportunity to see people who had worked all of their lives, firemen, police, teachers, nurses, and were losing their homes. And if I didn't do all of my part, I would feel somewhat remorse. So today, I am traveling around the country, working with families. When I leave you today, as I told Lynn, I'm in Los Angeles, and from Los Angeles, I'm in Las Vegas. Because I think the American dream is not out of reach for Americans. And I again reiterate what my mom and dad said in closing. It might be insane to live with a dream, but it is absolutely madness to live without one. Thank you all so much.
Would you like to join me here, or are you more
comfortable?
I'm
more comfortable here. I'll
okay,
stay.
Terrific. Well, that was a truly inspirational talk about a very difficult problem. Before coming here today, I came up with a few questions in case the audience was shy. I think we'll be here for another 5 hours answering these excellent questions. So I'm going to start with something that the real estate industry has been pondering. How did this happen? It's been so interesting to many of us that we really didn't see it coming. And when we heard about subprime loans, that we thought it was just a drop in the bucket. But because of subprime loans and because of problems in various industrial sectors like the auto industry, other types of foreclosures have gone up dramatically. It's so interesting that it took us a while to see this coming.
Yes, and let me say this to you. We saw it coming about 2.5 years ago. That was one of the reasons we asked Congress to modernize FHA, because we saw what was happening with many of these subprime loans. See, many of these loans were made over the internet. There was no verification of income. They were just made. And you have to understand what occurred, why they were made. because this was a lucrative business. The insurance broker or the mortgage insurance would make the loans under false pretenses. They would sell it to the bank. The bank would sell it to an investment house. Then investment house will sell it to China, to India, to Brazil. See, back when most of us bought homes in the 60s and 70s, banks held the notes. They don't hold notes anymore. And so in the process, the notes became so saturated and everybody was getting so rich, they didn't want to validate the income of people. See, in many cases, people were buying homes they couldn't afford. They were buying them interest only, thinking that in the final analysis, because we had had between 7 and 10% increase every year, that it was going to continue. But it did not. And so in the process, this is what we are left with, Lynn, is this. Now, let me say this to you. 80% of the subprime loans that are made are going to be fine. But we're looking at 2.1 million, 2.5 that are not going to be fine. So we must find ways to address those very quickly.
That's very helpful. I want to remind our radio audience that we are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is the Honorable Alfonso Jackson, U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, who is discussing the current mortgage and housing crisis.
One thing I'd like to do, if I can, Lynn, is introduce the regional director, is Richard Rainey.
Yes.
Yes, and the director of public affairs for us, Larry Bush.
And welcome. Wonderful to have you with us. One of the questions you've discussed, the amount of education and counseling and how helpful that has been. I'm very impressed by that. It sounds as if you are educating not just the homeowners, but the lenders
as well.
And I think that's so key. A question has come up as to how you educate the working and middle classes, specifically in the suburbs, and particularly with so many homeowners working 10 to 12 hours a day.
And that's a very excellent question. I was asked that question basically in Cleveland. The centers stay open to 9:30, 10. A number of the centers around the country does. And that's very, very important because they're open on Saturdays and Sundays because that's when many of the people can come in. And that was one of the things that Secretary Paulson and I stressed. You have to accommodate the persons who are facing this crisis, not accommodate the people who are trying to help. And once we do that, we've been successful. Let me give you an example. When we started this process almost 6 months ago, only 2% of the population really was taking advantage of our counseling, 2,300 counseling centers around the country. Today, it's a little over 20%. Now, you might say, well, that's only 18%. But think about how many people are being saved in that 18%. We'd like to go up much higher, and we will continue to go up. But we can only do that by accommodating the persons who are facing this problem. And we're doing that around the country. Otherwise, we have a monitoring system, and they're not going to keep getting our money.
That's good. So you have been using both the FHA Modernization Act, which you talked about the need to extend, and you've been using excellent, excellent counseling. Are there other enforcement capabilities which you have or would like to have?
Yes, we would. I would say this. If we can get the Congress to reconcile the FHA Modernization Bill, that will help us tremendously. Secondly, we can't force the lending institutions to do anything, but we're using the moral persuasion of this administration to convince them that they have an obligation, having made these loans, to help many of these people overcome the process that they're facing today. Now, I will tell you something. The loans are not for second homes. I have no feelings towards second homes. It's for the persons who have all their lives worked to own a home, finally own the home, and are facing some issues that they did not expect. And so, therefore, we have a responsibility, I think, as Americans to help other Americans. And we're talking about people who are just like us in this audience, who did not necessarily read everything that was in the print. And let me say this to you because, you know, we got some people in Washington say, well, they didn't read. Well, you know something? I'm an attorney, and I didn't read all the fine print. So if I didn't read all the fine print, I'm not expecting a teacher or a fire person to read all the fine print. The only difference is that I went to a reputable bank that was regulated by the government. So if they tell you that this was a fixed rate, it better be a fixed rate. That's the only difference. Because the mortgage insurer can tell you it's a fixed rate. And as Christine found out, it wasn't a fixed rate. It was an adjustable arm. So, yes, that's why we're looking at passing the Real Estate Settlement Procedure Act, so we can make it simple and you'll see exactly what you're getting. And we will be introducing that probably within the next 2 weeks.
That's excellent. I think we all will read the fine print much more carefully from today going forward. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke has suggested that more long-term solutions need to be in place to solve the housing crisis. What other long-term solutions would you suggest? And do you think they should all come under HUD, or are there other agencies that should be involved, including the Office of Thrift Supervision, which regulates the SNLs?
Let me answer it this way for you, Lynn. One of the first things you learn when you go to Washington is you do not give your opinion of an issue before Congress decides to act on the issue. Because once you give your opinion, you'll get called up to a hearing and ask certain questions. So I learned very early on when I gave one chairman my opinion on the Senate side, and he said, I was deputy secretary, he said something to the effect, deputy, when I need your opinion, I'll ask. So I will say that Chairman Dodd on the Senate side, Chairman Frank on the House side, are looking at ways to strengthen that process. I have talked to Chairman Franks on a number of occasions. He believes that clearly we will resolve this issue, but he doesn't want it to occur again. And so they are looking at legislation on both sides of the aisle. And so when they say, Alfonso, come and give us your opinion, I'll do it.
Very good. I should know that. I was born in Washington. So here's an interesting question. What do you believe the long-term effects of the home mortgage crisis will be on renters?
You know, it's already had an effect on renters because in some of these areas, a lot of the people who were in these homes were renters, and the homes were sold from under them without them ever having any input or understanding what occurred. And when I said, foreclosed under them. They were able, in many cases, to go other places. But if you take places like Canton, Ohio, Dayton, where you have severe problems, I think it presents serious problems to be able to find a moderate rental property that you can afford, especially when you're working a job that is not high paying. So it's had an effect not only on the homeowners who lived in the homes, but it had an effect on those persons who decided that once their house went underwater, and when we say underwater, it means that you owe more than the house is worth, so they walk away mm-hmm. from it. And the person who is renting the house ends up in 3 or 4 months having to find somewhere else to go. So I think it's had an effect on everybody in our economy, including the renters.
As we look at, I'll just follow up on that question. One of the issues that concerns a lot of us is the impact on the economy. We have the housing markets in chaos. That is causing drop in consumer confidence. It's causing consumers to stop spending money on furniture and home appliances. And that has a ripple effect through the economy. Do you think that this, what have you, I'm trying, what do you think that will be in terms of the impact on of recession?
I don't think we're going to have a recession. I really do not believe that. I think our economy has slowed, but our economy still is growing. It's not growing as fast as it used to grow. The housing sector has slowed it down tremendously. But see, when, and I'll say this again because I like to emphasize, when you're the last of 12, you're a pretty optimistic person because you have to fight for what you want. So I read every day in the paper what many of the papers say, predicting doom and gloom. I don't see that. Our economy is still extremely strong. Do we have some weak links in our economy? Yes. But Secretary Paulson, Chairman Bernanke, and I meet quite frequently to discuss these issues, and I just don't see it. Are we going to have the vibrant economy that we had a year and a half ago? No. But are we sliding into a recession within the, I just read in the paper, within the next 90 to 120 days, and last night I saw on the television? No, I don't believe that. Now, three of us could be wrong. Now, I'm average, but the other two guys are real smart, so I think they know what they're talking about.
That makes me think of some of the comments about the housing market, that when we talk about the nation's housing market, it's kind of like asking, what's the weather like in the United States? Well, it isn't the same in all areas.
No, it isn't.
And I thought that, and you've commented on that a bit, or, and certainly did before our session started. Would you like to share your thoughts?
Let me give you an example. I loved 2 years ago, or 3.5 years ago, when people asked the question, do we have a national housing bubble? There's no such thing as a national housing bubble. Housing is regional. That's what it is. Now, do we have a greater slowdown in the Southwest, the Midwest, the Southeast? Absolutely. That's probably the hardest hit part. And let me explain to you why it is. Because I'm from Dallas, Texas. And Dallas overbuilt. So if you live in Frisco and you decide to sell your house that's 2 years old, you're going to have a difficult time selling it because we've moved further out to McKinney so I can buy a new home that no one's ever lived in, probably for $30,000 cheaper, and it's just as big. So why should I buy a house that's 2 years old? So the house sits there, not for 90 days, not for 180 days, more like a year. It will sell, but the price is coming down. But you take San Francisco. There's nowhere to build here. Prices are not going down very much. They're not going down. You don't have the land mass to rebuild anything. You have to tear down and rebuild. Well, as Lynn and I said, you have to build up. Can't build. California, in certain areas, yes, where industry is left, like Stockton. But you have to understand, in Boston, in New Hampshire, in Vermont, prices have gone down very little. Houses are still selling because they can't build. They don't have the land mass. Where there's land mass, we have problems in the country. There's no question. And we have to acknowledge that. But I can tell you this. Even in the crisis that we're facing, I would not like to be in San Francisco talking about buying a home, because it's not going to be much different than it was 8 months ago or 10 months ago or a year ago. Just not going to happen. So when people start talking to me about we've got a national bubble, no, we don't have a national bubble. We don't. Take where I live in Virginia. People are still buying homes there. You know the difference today? Until this process started, homes were selling within 90 to 120 days. Today they're selling between 120 days and 180 days. The price is down about 5%. Where if you go to Dallas, Fort Worth, Chicago, Miami, best example is Miami. Take the condos that's been built there. They overbuilt, and they're 20 to 25% down. So this is the time to go to Miami and buy if you want to live in a high-rise. And all you have to do, really, is just look around the nation. I look all the time on the Internet just to see the fluctuation in prices. You know, I was looking the other day and at a house in a, I forget the name of the city, but it was in Georgia. 8,000 square feet. I think it was 5-bedroom, 5.5 baths. $415,000. That same house, if it was sitting in Virginia, it would be $5 million. Now, if I was getting ready to move, I'd probably go buy it.
It all goes back to real estate is local.
That's right.
And those are very good points. So we're seeing the same thing here. We're seeing somewhat longer days on the market. Right. I look at exactly the same trends that you do. We've talked about the regional aspects and supply and demand, and some of it being in areas where there's been overbuilding. Some of it has also been in areas like Detroit, where entire neighborhoods are affected, and where we're seeing places of increasing blight, tremendous need for economic development, high unemployment, mostly also in Ohio, mostly due to the auto industry. Will your department get into those issues of economic development?
No, we will not. And let me say this to you. I have great sympathy for the city of Cleveland and the city of Detroit. I've been to both of them. And I happen to see a whole street of physically sound homes that are in foreclosure because most of the people were in the auto industry. I'm not convinced we're going to be able to bring that back. I think it's going to take the state's innovativeness to come up with some ideas. It's like you have to retool. And so I think they're going to have to retool themselves in order to address the issue. As you know, General Motors and Chrysler just talked about laying off, I think it was 20,000 more workers. So it's going to be very difficult. We're in for a long haul for those areas.
We are, and certainly those states have tried to attract business to them, and it's a good point that the states need to really participate here. I am reminded to remind the radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is the Honorable Alfonso Jackson, U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, who is educating us on the current mortgage and housing crisis. So I thank you for that. Here's an interesting question, which is that a member of our audience has started to think about different types of housing. This crisis has brought us into a variety of concerns, and this person is asking, what can we do to foster more homebuyer-driven collaboratives and cooperative solutions for home ownership, like co-housing, land trust, housing co-ops that can maintain affordability and support aging in place?
That's an excellent question. Let me answer it this way. One of the biggest obstacles that we face in California is the regulatory barriers. Before a home comes out of the ground here, it is somewhere between $96,000 and $115,000. That effectively prices people out of the market. And then it takes you probably 18 months to 2 years to get all of the certificates that you need to start building. I think we need to first come to the conclusion with your state legislature and say this has got to stop. You know, I was in Thousand Oaks, California, speaking at the Ronald Reagan Library a couple of years ago. And the average home there was a little over $2 million. So I asked the mayor of the city, not being facetious, just really asked him. I said, if you have a serious catastrophe here, your service providers can't get to you, the nurses, the police, the teachers. Because I spoke to some policemen and teachers. They were driving an hour to 20, an hour and 30 minutes to get to work. Well, ask yourself a simple question. How effectively can you be if you're driving an hour and 20 minutes, an hour and 30 minutes to get to work? You've lost a lot of your effectiveness. Then, what if the child at school wants to stay to go over some math with the teacher? If he or she has to drive another hour and a half, they're going to leave at 3 o'clock. So I said, at that point in time, I said, you know, as I was coming up here, I said, I saw all of this beautiful land. I said, adjacent to Thousand Oaks. I said, why don't you build an affordable community? I'll never forget what one person, and I don't know what this person did, said to me at that point in time. He said, well, that will devaluate our homes. Well, wait a minute. See, now, I'm not the smartest person, but I think I got a lot of common sense. I said to myself, if the fireman is good enough to protect you, the police is good enough to protect you, the teacher is smart enough to teach your kid, the nurse is smart enough to take care of you, it would seem that you wanted them close, not far away, and not create barriers that keep them from living in proximity of you rather than distance from you. You think a lot of them, with the services they're providing, then I would say you should think about making sure they're close to you. So if you have an emergency, the emergency can be addressed. And I think if we began to address those regulatory barriers like San Jose did, I think you'll see it. They created affordable housing communities, dropped those regulatory barriers, and are creating affordable housing. You have to have the will to do that. And if you have the will to do it, it can be done. I saw it done in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I mean, it has to come from the top to want to get it done.
That is so true. And we and others have done studies that show that affordable housing has no negative impact
None.
On the surrounding market rate housing units. So that's think that I certainly agree with you so strongly on that, and we have much more that needs to be done. Here's a provocative question, and it may be pretty close to our, we've got about 5 minutes left,
okay.
So let me ask you this. Is there a need for Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae anymore? Should they be abolished? I never would have thought of it.
I think they have a role to play. I just want them to play it. There's no question. I want them to follow their charter. Their charter is to create affordable mortgages, to buy affordable mortgages so banks will be able to make more affordable loans to people. And we have been on them to follow that, and I will continue to be on them until I leave as secretary. And they have been making every effort to follow it. You have to understand that that Fannie and Freddie became very powerful, and it was very difficult to regulate them. And we made a decision that they were going to be regulated when we came in, and we are. And we're making them more accountable. And they can still do more. As I said to them, when they started talking about not having liquidity, I said, sell some of those high-priced loans you got and make more loans to teachers, firemen, police, and nurses. They can do that. So I do think they're relevant, but you have to hold their feet to the fire.
Absolutely, which I think is almost the answer to another question, which is the issue of public-private partnerships in terms of the creation of affordable housing. And I think we do need to think carefully about that.
Let me say this to you about that, because I've been so heavily criticized, because I believe that people should be integrated both socially and economically. And so I have stressed that issue continuously. We in the government should go out and make efforts to find private developers who are willing to work with us, because they still have resources. And that's similar to what we do in the Hope 6 program. We give a housing authority an amount of money and say, find a developer who will leverage that money. That's the same thing we do in the home program. We say, go out and find a developer who will leverage that money. And in many cases, the home program is, we give $1, they leverage with $3. We can only give so much. But I have come to the conclusion that the best way to increase a person's sense of worth is not to separate them from other people who are doing well, but to integrate them with people who are doing well. They see the person is doing well, then they decide they want to do something better. And I truly believe that the influence is great upon people. And too often what we have here in this country is we sectionalize people. We said, well, because you are making $50,000 or less, really you shouldn't be living in this community. Or we said, if you're making $300,000, you can live in this community. I think that if we integrate housing both socially and economically, we're not going to have a problem. You know, I venture to guess, as I just said a few minutes ago, that if Thousand Oaks decided to do that, nobody will care that the fireman or the nurse lives next door. They'll be happy that they live next door. And the value of the property is not going down. And that's one of the things that we see in places like San Francisco or Washington, D.C. or Virginia. See, when you have no land, you build where you have land, where you have a chance to build. I will tell you, if you come to our townhouse where I live in Virginia, across the street from me is modular housing. That's across the street. And it's predominantly Hispanic. But you know something? Our townhouses are worth an awful lot of money. An awful, awful lot of money. And they haven't gone down. And they're not going down. Mm-hmm. Even though across the street is marginal housing. Because there's nowhere else to build. That's the answer. If there's nowhere to build, you did. When we built those townhouses, we knew there were modular houses across the street. But they're good people. There's nothing wrong. And that's the way you have to look at life. See, let me close with this again, another piece of wisdom that I have. See, my mom and dad used to say something. Well, anyway, I'll tell you this. The older I get, the smarter my mom and dad becomes. I know that. And my dad used to say that you treat beggars and kings the same, because the beggar today might be the king tomorrow, and the king today might be the beggar tomorrow. So you respect people if they carry themselves right, not for the amount of money that they have, not for the way they dress, but how they treat you and how they treat the community in which they live. It's that simple.
That's so true, and I had a couple of thoughts as you were talking about our firemen and policemen. And when you live in California with the threat of an earthquake, you want them close by.
I know I would.
So this has been just wonderful. Our thanks to the Honorable Alfonso Jackson, U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. We thank our audiences here on radio and television. I'm Lynn Sedway, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.